Richard Betts picking on that red guitar. So get around, now get around, chill and be down. Well, just get down, chill and get loud. Well, you can be loud, yeah, and be proud. And you can be proud, yeah, and I'll be proud. You will ever, because South's gonna do it again and again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Thursday, more than 34 minutes after the hour. So to come on the program in about an hour from now, House Majority Leader Nathaniel Ledbetter, Rainsville will be with us at 11 o'clock hour from the Trestle Tribune by our friend Scott Buttram. And from Alabama Daily News, our usual Thursday guest, Todd Stacey, joining us as well. 251-343-0106. If you'd like to respond to anything you're hearing this morning on the program. Joining us now, very pleased to bring on my next guest. Always makes time for this show, and we're very, very appreciative of that. Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall on the line with us. General Marshall, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Hope everything's well down your way.
So far, so good. Let's get right into it. A few things I want to talk about. Obviously, you sent out an advisory or a press release that pertains to, I guess, misuse of an immunization database that, I guess, private companies were using it or misusing it, and that could be in violation of the no vaccine passport law as it pertains to COVID-19.
Yeah, Jeff, it's actually broader than that. You know, one thing that I've learned, and I think sort of COVID has taught us a lot about maybe what we have on the healthcare side, but there is an historical state immunization registry known as Imprint, in which all of our vaccination records are kept. And that's really for a couple purposes. One, to make sure that our healthcare providers know what our vaccination history is so that we don't get unnecessary vaccinations, and the state tries to keep up with that data. But only healthcare providers have access to it, but it's for the purpose of patient care. And what we received were some very specific complaints about those healthcare providers who have access to that database, not using it for patient care, but using it as a method to confirm whether or not their employees have in fact been vaccinated or not. And clearly that is in violation of the ability to access that information. It's inappropriate for an employee to have their healthcare employer to be able to look at that information for other than their specific healthcare reasons. And so we felt it not only important to at least initiate an investigation with regard to the specific complaints that we've received, but also to make sure that we sent out broadly that anybody that has access to this database can only use it for purposes of patient care and can't use it for any other reason, specifically to be able to confirm whether or not their employees have been vaccinated.
Is this a widespread thing? I mean, how much are you hearing about this?
Yeah, I don't think it's widespread in the sense that, you know, typically employers, for example, are not going to have access to this database. It's really only healthcare providers that otherwise would have a reason to access it. Those are the ones that are really being targeted. So this is not something that I think is a uniform policy across the board. But what we do believe is that there's at least one and maybe others that have used it improperly, clearly in violation of state law. In fact, could ultimately result in criminal penalties. And we felt it important yesterday to be very clear that that would be an improper act.
Are you finding a lot of, you know, we haven't talked, since that whole Birmingham Southern episode, but are you finding this to be more common that companies or businesses or institutions or schools are looking for a way around, the idea of vaccine passports are trying to require some kind of proof of vaccination? How much is that coming into play?
Yeah, we've seen, and we've had many back channel conversations with, particularly those that the law applies to specifically. Because remember, there's some distinctions as it relates to private business versus governmental entities. There's much broader prohibitions involving governmental entities than private businesses. But, we've attempted to talk with people in good faith that have called to ask questions to try to make sure that their policies are consistent. But also we have concerns that there are others that have attempted to, sort of craft language that we believe is an effort to avoid, what is clear responsibility under the act itself. And look, Jeff, I recognize that we are dealing with a very difficult situation in respect to the fact that this pandemic has raised issues, but very similar to kind of what you've heard from me talking about the monument law. is that if we are a state that believes in the rule of law, that if we abide by this concept that the legislature defines what our conduct should be, and it's our responsibility to conform it to what the laws are of the state, then whether it be private individuals or as well as businesses, then the responsibility is to be able to follow the law. And so we hope that people respect and see that. But at the same time, we've seen instances in which we've had to be engaged to try to change those who would ignore what otherwise the legislature has done. And so, again, I think it's fundamental that even in those difficult periods in which we're attempting to make sure that we are doing what we can to stop the spread of this pandemic, that we do it in a way that's consistent with what the legislature's defined our conduct can be, as well as confine it within the limitations that they've set out as to what can and can't be done with regard to policy.
What if you feel like, say, you work for a state agency or you work for one of these educational institutions that fall under this law, what do you do? Do you get in touch with your office, or what is the right call to action?
Obviously we welcome folks to be able to notify us, and happy to be able to look at it. But one of the things that doesn't exist, and I'll use again the example that we talked about a second ago with regard to the monument law. When the legislature established the bill that said if you have a monument over 40 years old, or some, whether it be a building that's been named for an individual that's of a certain years, and they try to move it, change it, alter it, then it creates the responsibility for the attorney general to investigate and then seek civil penalty for violations of it. The vaccine passport law does not have that same provision. There is no direct enforcement responsibility that exists. And so within that, one of the things that is clear is that although they don't delegate that enforcement responsibility to our office, that an individual would have the right to be able to claim that any policy of their employer or of a business as it related to the ability to access goods and services or a building, that becomes actionable in court. And so individuals clearly have the right to be able to seek that remedy. One of the things that we have told folks is that to the extent that lawsuits are filed, we're happy to be able to look at it and see whether or not we need to weigh in, which we have the opportunity to be able to do quite frequently among various laws of the state. But there's no doubt that there is the individual would have a right to be able to assert that interest, and to the extent that they believe it had been violated, to be able to seek a remedy in court.
I know you say that there are exceptions to this law, and maybe this isn't a question for you, but as it pertains to, let's say you work at the like a UAB hospital or University of South Alabama hospital, that it is still government. Does that change things that you're in the medical profession?
No, it doesn't change things in the medical profession. And I think, the real question becomes, what is the entity itself that is requiring the act? So that, if it's a private entity, then that becomes one thing. If it's a governmental entity, it is another. And frankly, and Trevor probably gets a little bit more into the weeds than we got time to talk, but to some extent, the way that hospitals are managed may be subject to a little deeper dive to determine, what is the legal entity that is in charge, who do individuals work for, and is the policy itself cast a net far broader than simply the private entity, but include those who are subject to being public employees. And so it's a fact-driven analysis that, each of them are unique. And so, again, to the extent that there are employees at those facilities or others in which they believe that their rights have been aggrieved, they have the right to be able to assert that in court. And again, it's something that we would take a hard look at and being able to weigh in as well.
Joined by Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall here on the program. General, the next thing, I think it's always important to remind people, especially this time of year, that Alabama does have these anti-price gouging laws in effect when in times of emergency situations and as tropical weather approaches the Gulf Coast or whatever. As a refresher, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, anytime that there is a declared state of emergency, the provisions of price gouging come into play. And although we don't have a set standard for what price gouging is, there is a presumption that's created that for certain sale of consumer goods as well as lodging prices, if there's an increase in that price of 25% over what has been kind of a 30-day average, then that becomes something that is potentially actionable. And so one of the things that when we receive complaints, we send out letters and ask for documentation of wholesale prices, for example, and a history of pricing to be able to look at. And we have the ability to be able to then act in those circumstances. So we have a place on our website where people can be able to file complaints. They can also call our office. We'll accept those complaints over the phone. You know, fortunately, what we've seen with Ida, as we've had very few complaints thus far, and they've all actually been related specifically to hotel prices. And so we'll investigate those. But I think right now we saw that we were pretty blessed with the storm that went to our friends in Louisiana. And we obviously had a lot of rain, but we clearly did not have the impact of others. But anytime we see natural disasters occur, we usually have a state or declaration of emergency from the governor go in play. And so these price gouging laws would likewise be applicable.
General, let's move on to what's going on kind of now in Montgomery. These discussions about prison reform, how close are you watching these negotiations?
Oh, very closely, and clearly from the standpoint of the person responsible for the litigation involving the Department of Justice, as well as what's going on in the mental health litigation as well. You know, facilities are critically important. You know, one of the things that I've told folks many, many times is that really this case has primarily about the facilities and how people are housed, the guards and our ability to appropriately staff the facilities, and then the programs that are involved to deal with physical and mental health of inmates. And so the discussions going on with the legislature right now are moving that ball forward. Appreciate the fact that they have continued to do that since the governor's plan did not come to fruition with regard to the private leases. But the one thing, Jeff, that I want to make clear is that, you know, people want to conflate a little bit of the question of what we're doing with facilities to this wholesale reform of the criminal justice laws. And those are two totally different scenarios. What federal judge is going to be looking at is how are inmates housed, what they sort of refer to as inside the wire while they're in prison. It is not about how we sentence individuals. It's not about the circumstances of what our theft laws may be and the thresholds that exist. You know, we have the ability to house inmates constitutionally, whether we have 10 or whether we have 10,000. And so the question for us in the litigation is really about, you know, what we're doing inside for inmates. And it's up to the legislature to eventually decide what our criminal justice policy is in the state, but yet don't discuss those in the terms of using that as a way of resolving the lawsuit, because they're two solely separate things.
Well, and it appears that's why a lot of, you know, some folks in the legislature on the Democrat side of the aisle are pushing that you need to get the number of incarcerated down. You don't have enough beds. You argue that that's not really what this DOJ complaint is about. It's more about the quality of conditions and not the quantity.
Yeah, I think it's about whether or not we meet that constitutional minimum care of inmates that have been established kind of through multiple cases, describing what that is across the facilities within the state. And so I think many on the left would use the DOJ case to accomplish the goals of reform that, frankly, I don't think are helpful. And in fact, I think danger public safety, when you look at right now violent crime rates going across this country, what we've seen a spike in violent crime in Alabama, I don't think we need to talk about lessening the punishment for those who engage in violent acts and violate our criminal laws in the state.
General, so there's also this discussion that we need a shakeup at the Board of Pardons and Paroles. And I think things really changed after the Jimmy O'Neill Spencer incident that you're very familiar with that happened up in Marshall County. But when you look at that, is that an avenue? Is that a mechanism that needs to be discussed in this whole discussion about prison reform?
No, not in my mind. In fact, I think the board has done exactly what they've been called to do. And to some extent, if we compare prior boards with this one, I think you got to ask the question, was the prior board concerned about public safety or were they concerned about letting inmates out? You know, the primary concern in a parole decision for an inmate ought to be whether or not they potentially are a significant threat to public safety, and is it appropriate for them to be released out into the general population. There's no doubt that the people that are in there have been given a defined sentence. Parole is a benefit for somebody to be able to get out earlier than they otherwise would be entitled to. And one of the things that we've been very clear on throughout as we had these discussions of what the parole board should be is that their focus should be on making sure that whoever is released, that there is confidence that that person is going to be able to come out and be a productive member of society. And so I think every case is unique, ought to be evaluated on their individual circumstances. And what we've seen is a board that's been responsible thus far with decisions. Greatly appreciate Lee Gwofney's leadership as chair, and they need to be that independent arm acting on behalf of the general public to make sure that we're considering public safety paramount and whether or not inmates can be safely released back into society to be productive in their future lives.
And just one more question on that, and as I am maybe not as familiar as I should be, but are the guidelines or the rules clear enough when it, as it pertains to the Pardon and Parole Board that they are being followed to satisfaction in your judgment?
Well, there are guidelines, but they're not defined standards. I mean, this was a reform that I think goes back to what Senator Ward did back in 2014, roughly, if I recall, where the board itself is given criteria to be able to examine and evaluate and then make their own independent judgment as to whether or not, again, somebody should be released. You know, I think there's been some discussion similar to what they've done with sentencing guidelines to make those factors presumptive on a board so that, in essence, they're checking the box and have to find out if they meet certain criteria, then they absolutely have to be released. I don't think we want to get rid of discretion of people to evaluate records. That's why that board is there. That's why they ultimately are serving in that role. And I would be against any effort to somehow or another tie their hands in making decisions, whether releasing them or not releasing them, and allow them to be able to use good common sense and judgment in making those decisions.
General, we got to leave it there. You've been very kind with your time. We got a lot covered there. I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Have a great day.
You do the same. It's Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall there on the line. We got to get a break here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5.